On behalf of the Fonts House Board of Governors, I'd like to welcome you to the last lecture in this year's Contemporary Lecture Series. Our speaker this evening is Representative Adam Clayton Powell, who was born in New Haven, Connecticut, 1918. He received his Bachelor of Arts degree from Colgate in 1930 and his Master's from Columbia University in 1932. He also has a law degree and a ministerial degree. In 1944, Mr. Powell was elected to the United States Congress on all tickets and has served as a Democratic representative for the past 20 years. He now ranks 39th in seniority in the House of Representatives and has been chairman of the House Committee on Education and Labor since 1961. Representative Powell is also a life member of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. This past week, Representative Powell has been in the news once again, this time giving his views on a subject of great interest to many of us here tonight, the draft. In this vein, it's rather appropriate that he's speaking on the eve of the first Selective Service Examination. It gives me great pleasure at this time to present to you the representative from New York, Adam Clayton Powell, who will speak on the decline of the white power in America. Mr. Powell.
When I walked in, I wanted to know where the hockey team was. Last time I was here was in 1929 on Thanksgiving Day when I played with Colgate University against Brown, and I will not insult you by telling you what the score was. That was the great team, Eddie Tryon. I didn't play, by the way. I was about fifth or sixth team. But I was on the squad, and that's probably the greatest record of any football team. We were undefeated, untied, unscored upon, ultimately uninvited, and then the crash came and we were unemployed. What I'm going to say is relatively unimportant, as usual, but the questions which you will ask are going to be of much more benefit to me, and I hope my answers to you, than my remarks. I would like to talk tonight, since I have been invited to talk about politics, and I regret my beloved twin is not here, Drew Pearson, about the decline and fall of the white power structure in the United States. This past Tuesday, May 3rd, will be enshrined in history as the day the pillars of the Temple of White Supremacy were sledgehammered into disintegrating shards by an aroused black vote. In Alabama, the mere prospect of thousands of blacks voting for the first time, many of them as old as 85, frightened the bantamweight of race hatred into frigid silence about integration. For the first time in recent memory, a major Southern white candidate openly campaigned for the black vote as black men forgot their place, quote unquote, and ran for public office in Alabama under the arrogant delusion they were Americans. And I do not use the word arrogance right now, as Senator Fulbright used it the other day. It worked. A few were elected, most were defeated, but the lesson was not lost on the white power structure of a watchful nation. The black man is on the march everywhere, including the South, toward political equality, and he's knocking at the lily-white doors of governors' mansions, congressional offices, positions of mayor, city councilman, and sheriff in every southern state, county, and hamlet. I can never forget the time that Hale Boggs was in the Democratic cloakroom with a group of southern segregationists, and they were discussing who would be a good candidate for president. This was before our beloved John Fitzgerald Kennedy was nominated. And one of them said, "How about Hubert Humphrey?" Said, "He talks too much." Last night he only talked 10 minutes, by the way. And what about John Fitzgerald Kennedy? He's Catholic. And what about Stu Symington? Well, he's a little too stiff. So Hale Boggs, just for the hell of it, said, "Well, what about Adam Clayton Powell?" And before the Southern segregationists could answer the question, Hale Boggs said, "You're right. The country's not ready for a Baptist minister." Even in the North, where whites have lied to themselves for decades that they love blacks, the winds of political change are sweeping out the debris of de facto segregation. Let me say parenthetically that while in the South black people were being lynched, having their homes and churches bombed, even their children being bombed in Sunday school, in the North, whites have practiced a more subtle form of genocide. Whites have assigned black people to paying a tax for being black. Where we live, and when I say we, I mean it, you're looking at the only so-called civil rights leader, because there isn't any real civil rights leader. We got 20 million black people and 20 million leaders. But I live in the slums, in Harlem and in Washington. And we pay a tax on being black. More for our food, more for our clothing, and much more for our housing. Small wonder the northern black reacted and asserted his political independence by challenging the white power structure, as Carl Stokes did last year in Cleveland, where he lost the race for mayor by a mere 2,000 votes. This past Tuesday, the candidacy of two black candidates in Newark, New Jersey, prevented the re-election of Mayor Adonisio, and he has now been forced into a runoff. In New York City, one of my colleagues in politics, a black man, Raymond Jones, is chairman of the county Democratic organization, Tammany Hall. I can see all the old Irishmen twirling in their graves. The Republican mayor has moved to involve black people in New York into policy-making positions. And the only remaining political Lilliputian of racism is the Liberal Party in New York, which refuses to accept black people in its decision-making councils or black people even in policy-making positions in its unions, such as the ILGW, the garment workers. The black revolt of 63 and 64 is just beginning to bear political fruit. As Billie Holiday used to sing years ago, God bless her, "Strange fruit hanging from a Georgia tree." Now, this is a new revolt. It's beginning to bear political fruit. Black people marched on Washington to shake the roots of the white power structure. Less than 2 years later, black candidates ran for office in every city, county, and state where blacks are registered in sizable numbers. And an interesting sidelight, and my special assistant Chuck Stone is here. May I pause and tell you how the federal voters registration bill was enacted? Dr. Aaron Henry, president of the NAACP of Mississippi, came into my office on January 10th, direct from the National Board of Directors meeting of the NAACP, and said, I have an idea that the federal government can register people for elections. When I presented this just this afternoon to the Board of Directors of the NAACP, Mr. Roy Wilkins said, we will refer this to Clarence Mitchell and Francis Poolhouse in Washington, and we can work this out maybe in 2 or 3 months. That was January 10th. I picked up the phone and I called my legislative counsel, George Skinner. I said, I want a bill drawn up on these lines tomorrow, and the record will show that the first bill was introduced into Congress on January the 12th that ultimately led to the Federal Registration Act for voters in federal, voting. That was the result of Aaron Henry of Mississippi and myself on January the 10th. There are 76 congressional districts today where blacks constitute 25% or more of the electorate. And those southern districts where blacks are a majority, it's just a matter of voter registration. It's not even time before I shall have the privilege of sitting next to black congressmen from the Deep South. As I told old man Rankin from Tupelo, Mississippi, years ago on the floor of Congress, and he's gone, I said, the day may come, Mr. Rankin, when I'll go down to Mississippi and run for governor. Can you imagine the electric transformation that will take place in the hearts and minds of whites when Mississippi sends its first black man to Congress since the Civil War? And it's going to come very soon. 15 years ago, there were only 2 black congressmen in the halls of the United States House of Representatives. That's incorrect. 22 years ago, I was the second one. Bill Dawson was there 2 years before me. I've been a member of Congress 22 years. Today there are 6. Tomorrow, when I say tomorrow, I mean tomorrow, there will be 18 black congressmen from southern and northern states. An absurd prediction? Far from it. And when one realizes that blacks comprise 12% of this country, 18 will be only 3% of the number of congressmen. But to accomplish this goal, I am urging blacks all over America not only to vote in blocks, but to register in blocks. This is called black nationalism. But I believe that we can indulge in the luxury of non-black nationalism after we have brought the statistics up to the place where they should be in terms of black men and women in office in this nation. The history of this country is enriched by the splendor of racial and ethnic assimilation. But in every single instance, the Poles, the Italians, the Irish, the Jews, political breakthroughs and control of the political apparatus of America's cities and states was first achieved through ethnic groups. Together, these groups built the white power structure in the big cities. The important point I wish to stress here is there is no longer a white power structure. I never forget when McNamara came before my friend from Charleston, head of the Armed Services Committee. What's his name, Chuck? Yeah. Came before the head of the Armed Services Committee, Mendel Rivers. Carl Vinson had ruled the Armed Services Committee with an iron hand for about 35 years. And Carl Vinson of Georgia, who was my friend, resigned and Mendel Rivers of Charleston, South Carolina, became the chairman. McNamara came before the Armed Services Committee for the first time since Rivers had become chairman, and in his usual blustering way proceeded to dominate everything. And when members of the Armed Services Committee wanted to interrupt McNamara, he wouldn't recognize him and proceeded to talk. And Rivers, after a few minutes, pounded his gavel and looked at McNamara and said, "Mr. Secretary, Mr. Vincent is not here anymore. He's gone." White power structure is gone. The lily-white, smoke-filled back rooms have now been replaced by the integrated coffee clutch. Today, there is only a power structure. The white power structure is gone with the wind. Whether white politicians like it or not, they now must take cognizance of the black vote in their platforms, promises, performances, appointments, and their records. And this is more than true of the Republican Party, because the Republican Party, if it keeps on its shift towards segregationism, will be even more forgotten than it is now. And that's almost impossible to think of. Where black voters enjoy the preponderance of power, political bosses must share the political spoils with them. Where black voters are a mere statistic, political bosses must still compute the possibility of victory or defeat in relation to the expectant percentage of black voters. Now, the other day when I used what might be ingloriously described as a pocket veto to kill the common situs picketing bill, the freshman members of Congress, the Democrats, came to me and said I was their hero, because about 40 of the freshman Democrats in Congress were elected by a percentage of 5% or less. And when Johnny Beckles of the Associated Press asked me just the other day, did I ever think I was going to bring it up again? And I said, yes, I'll bring it up in February. And then Congressman John Dent of Pennsylvania of my committee said, which year? Quite frequently, the aspirations of black voters are different from the expectations of white voters. You see, we black people, and I know when you look at someone like me, you say, why does he call himself black? Well, black is a way of thinking. It's not a color. That's why we had so many fine young white men and women go to Mississippi last summer, and some of them died there. Their skin was white, but they thought black. You see, we black people have been oppressed so hard and so long, we are still more interested in knowing where our bread and butter is coming from today than whether or not democratic values will be preserved tomorrow, 11,000 miles from Providence in a foreign land. Selfish? Indeed it is. We blacks have stood outside in the cold, watching hungrily as whites have gorged themselves on the delights of democracy, a democracy premised on the belief that all men are created equal, but practiced only for those with white skins. Yet blacks have never lost their faith in democracy's dream. Each black man and woman has been, as Lowell wrote, right after the Civil War and the present crisis, a pagan, suckled in a creed outworn, so might I, standing on this pleasant lea, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn, have sight of Proteus rising from the sea, or hear old Triton blow his wreath of horn. But the wreath of horn that summons the black man to die in Vietnam and the Dominican Republic blows for us of hypocrisy. Wayne Morse asked McNamara, and you read it in the press, day before yesterday, he said, was Adam Powell correct when he said that more black men are dying in Vietnam, percentage-wise, than whites? He said, we keep no percentages. The same morning, in the New York Times, his own assistant, was it Moskowitz? Moskowitz stated the exact percentages that I had used. McNamara's own assistant. And so I called up Wayne Morse and told him. He said, yes, he had read the Times. McNamara said, we keep no statistics. The truth of it is, 22.5% of black men who volunteer, not drafted, for Vietnam are the casualties. And I believe, and I know you're not going to like what I'm going to say, but I'm that kind of human being, I believe that any black man who volunteers to fight a white man's war against colored people ought to be killed. It will be the black man who will inspire a new revolution in compassion and understanding for one's fellow man, in the language of one of our great spirituals, to lay down our sword and shield down by the riverside and study war no more. We, LBJ, my friend, USA, that I love more than any other country in the world, we cannot dominate the world by force. Never has been done, and never will be done. The Chinese have a proverb that in an argument, the person who strikes the first blow confesses they have lost the argument. Yet, hallucinated by the LSD of power, we are fast losing this knowledge of history. The idea of democracy is the greatest idea that man has ever conceived. And you can't make an idea transform the world through force. Yes, I'm a pacifist, and I always have been one. That's why I'm opposing the war in Vietnam. That's why I oppose the Hitler draft deferment tests which began tomorrow morning. Because these tests will select out the culturally gifted and conscript for cannon fodder the intellectually deprived. The draft deferment test tomorrow and in June and the last one in July will mean more Mexican-Americans, Puerto Rican-Americans, Americans of Asiatic descent, Negroes, Appalachians, poor whites that are just getting into college now through the massive bills that have come out of my committee. It'll mean that those are the ones that'll be going in. That's the Hitler concept. And don't argue with me about this, because I know what I'm talking about. They were going to fingerprint you tomorrow, you know about that. And in 72 hours, my committee backed me up. In 72 hours, the draft boards changed their rules, and at least we have won a Pyrrhic victory. There will be no fingerprinting tomorrow. If we're going to fingerprint, let's fingerprint everybody, beginning with congressmen. Senator Dodd and Bobby Baker and Adam Powell. Hitler sought to build a super race of Aryans by educating the purest stock and slaughtering the uneducated. We will do the same tomorrow morning with the draft deferment tests, which are philosophically the same as the Berlin Wall of separate but unequal. I haven't got the power, but I wish I did. I wish I had fingers of fire to write across the sable breast of night, summoning the faculties and student bodies to boycott these tests tomorrow. Wish I could call upon the colleges and universities not to permit their facilities to be used. But I can't. But I have nevertheless deputized my chief of staff for education, Dr. Eunice Matthew, to investigate whether the money that has come out of the Committee of Education Labor for Higher Education Facilities is going to be used tomorrow and the succeeding days in June and July for the draft deferment test. And if they are, then I'm going to ask the Attorney General under the Civil Rights Act to prohibit the usage of these buildings. We did not vote these laws in Congress with the idea that they would be perverted. I call upon the members of the faculty, which should be the priesthood of knowledge and truth, to assume their roles as creative leaders in dissecting the false premises and inconsistencies which you young people are facing. None of these are possible. None of these are possible without the leadership of America's professors. You know, I haven't got good sense. I'm investigating, as of Monday, the CIA. I want to know if the CIA is utilizing college facilities in Michigan. And my son, who's at MIT, tells me the contracts have been arranged at MIT also. And I had an anonymous letter from a member of the faculty of University of Pennsylvania saying that they're being utilized there and gave me the names of some of the members of the faculty of the University of Pennsylvania who are on the CIA payroll. So we're going into this also. I want to know how the CIA, this super government that we have in the United States, can utilize the facilities and utilize the monies that we have appropriated for the pursuit of excellence by our American young people. As Walter Lippmann recently stated, today's professors have become the best source of guidance and authority in the field of knowledge. I wish this was true. I would perfect that source, and tonight I wish to make public my plan to establish a Congressional Distinguished Service Award for university professors. This award we arrived at are the young people on the campuses sending to the members of the Committee of Education and Labor, both Democrats and Republicans, their choice of who they think is the best member of the faculty in terms of really inspiring them. I will put that person on the payroll of my committee as a sort of professor in residence, or it might be professor in exile, at a salary of $25,500 for 1 year to creatively do anything that he or she desires. I hate to admit this, but I got the idea from Time Magazine's cover last week. Education alone will not resolve the tensions of our times nor the crises in human relations. But education is the floor of the house of brotherhood which the world must construct together. For an educated man stands, as it were, in the midst of a boundless arsenal filled with all the weapons which man's skill has been able to devise from the earliest time. The white power structure is finished. It has begun its slide into the darkness of obscurity because it was a power structure based upon divisiveness, steeped in ignorance. I've said many times in my 36 years of public life that very few white people really hate the black man. They just don't care, or they're ignorant about his affairs. There's a power structure that was unlearned in the ways of man's oneness. We are witnessing the fall of the white power structure in America. But we also are spectators to the rise and triumph of a new power structure. Power structure which embraces blacks as equals and breathes new life into democracy's soul. The embrace has not always been without abrasiveness in entry and in participation, as my own case illustrates. I infiltrated the white power structure on November 8th, 1960, when my predecessor, Graham Bard of North Carolina, announced that he would not run again for Congress. Graham Barden was one of the great throwbacks to the Pithecanthropus erectus. He was a man who believed that the earth am flat and the sun do move. On November the 8th, the day after election, I became chairman of the Committee of Education and Labor. Since that date, I have exercised audacious power. Not in the name of Adam Clayton Powell, but in the name of the new power structure that old Abraham Lincoln said would never perish from the earth. A power structure of the people, black and white, for the people, Jew and Gentile, and by the people, Catholic and Protestant. And in the 5 years of my chairmanship, this is my sixth year, as I said, the federal commitment to education has gone from $450 million to $10 billion. I have passed 53 laws and haven't lost one. To show you how the times have changed, when I revamped the FEPC law a week before last, which I authored when I went to Congress 22 years ago, I never got a hearing. When I did finally get a chance to bring it up, we stayed in session until 3 o'clock in the morning. Last week, I revamped that section of the civil rights law and gave the commissioner cease and desist powers instead of the dragging through the federal courts, which is now in that law. And it went through the House 3-1 without any rancor or bitterness or any filibustering. This is the way the times have changed. The minimum wage was extended for the first time since Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Senator Wagner in 1938. We talk about the minimum wage. It was never extended until I became chairman. And on this coming Tuesday, when I bring it up on the floor again, I will extend it to include 7 million more workers and escalate the wage up to $1.60 an hour. This is more important than commensitis or 14B. I'm speaking here at Brown. I'm a Baptist. I don't know whether Brown still is or not. I used to be against the church state doctrine.
But I believe that nothing should stand in the way of the pursuit of excellence. And I know that until I could resolve the question of church and state divisiveness, that I would not be able to put through the Congress an elementary and secondary education bill. And the concept of shared time, which has been working in many states of the Union for years, many areas, I put it into the bill on a federal basis. And today, for the first time in the history of our republic, I have bridged the gap between church and state in the field of education by having the concept of shared time, and on this coming Tuesday, the new elementary and secondary education bill for about $2 billion will be reported out of my committee, bridging the gap between church and state. I believe every American, whether they're a Catholic, a Jew, Lutheran, Baptist, or don't belong to any church, all of them should have a right to the federal participation in making their schools better schools. And through the shared time concept, this I have done as a Protestant clergyman. I just want to show you how the power structure has changed. 4 years, presidents of the United States from Roosevelt right on through to our beloved Jack Kennedy tried to get the law enacted, equal pay for equal work. Even Russia had it, Scandinavian countries had it, we didn't have it. I put that through, and today women get the same per hour, per day, per week wage that a man gets. They are no longer the scabs of labor that they were before I became chairman. The first federal anti-juvenile delinquency program. The first attempt to meet the threat of automation. The Manpower Development Training Act. All these came from me personally. After years of resistance from my many northern white liberal friends, the Powell Amendment, which now is a part of the Civil Rights Act, which bars federal aid to any school system practicing segregation, is now the law of the land. Oh, northern white liberals, beware of Greeks bearing gifts, colored men seeking loans, and northern white liberals. Someone said, what about southern white liberals? I said, I can take care of them. Probably one of the most important pieces of domestic legislation in this nation comes under the jurisdiction of my committee, the War on Poverty. Just yesterday afternoon, reported it out with many, many tightening amendments that I personally suggested, authorizing $1,750,000,000 to continue the assault on America's scourge. It is not sufficient. Leon Keisling, Mike Harrington, people who started the whole idea of the war on poverty, say we need at least $12 billion. I have taken the position openly, and I hope that my position will be undergirded one day by votes, that I believe we should spend at least as much money on America's poor as we do on foreign aid. But this is the best I could do, so it'll be $1,775,000,000, as we report out yesterday. It will not wipe out poverty overnight. Do you know we have over 1 million families in America, and most of them are white in Appalachia, whose total family income in the Great Society is less than $1,000 a year? I can take you into Harlan County, Kentucky, where my ranking Democrat, Carl Perkins, comes from, and show you white families whose average income in this day of the Great Society and the American affluence is $470 a year. I have
have long been deeply concerned about poverty. That's why I first evolved the concept. I was the one that evolved the concept of the domestic peace corps. And Sarge Shriver, 4 years ago, asked me to hold it off until he got his foreign peace corps rolling for at least 1 or 2 years, and I did. I don't know whether I was right or wrong. Sarge is such a wonderful salesman. This is why I first evolved the concept of the domestic peace corps, which subsequently became an act and is now known in the war on poverty as VISTA, Volunteers in Service to America. I first suggested the concept of an international education center so that American young people could go forth, not as missionaries of colonialism days gone by with the cross going before them and the sword afterwards. And this now has become a reality. I gave it to Johnny Bradamus. We passed it out the other day. We'll make it the law of the land in about 3 weeks. All of these ideas came out of the skull of this little old black boy from Harlem. That's why I know the white power structure is dead. Ideas only become meaningful when they are enacted into legislation. In the 5 years of my chairmanship, I told you that 103 bills have been passed out, 52 are now laws. Total federal money under my jurisdiction is now $19 billion. And that's what I call power, baby. That's power. Oh, yes. That's the kind of power that forces the white power structure to deal with me. And as soon as they deal with me, it's no longer white. See, that's the essence of this, of politics that I'm talking about tonight. As soon as the white power structure deals with me, then it's no longer white. Hope you see how obvious that is. Now, with such a strong record on behalf of labor and education during the 5 years of my chairmanship, one would think there would be a measure of harmony and goodwill in my relations with labor. Not until, as I said the other day, the AFL-CIO gets rid of its sterile, puerile, senile leadership. That's right. In this world where we're surging forward, you can't be led by men who are on crutches. Martin Luther King was telling me a story the other day. He said this mob was rushing up the street in Harlem, and the guys were trying to stop him, saying, "Where are you going?" "Shh, don't stop me." Finally, there was one guy way at the end, and he grabbed him and said, "Where are you going?" "He said, let go of me. I'm the leader." No. Let me reaffirm this evening that common citizens picketing benefits only a small segment of the labor population and the fat cats. Labor officials of the construction trade union, I told them 3 years ago, if you break down your apprenticeship training program, which is based upon nepotism, and I'm not against nepotism, as you know, I'm against mass nepotism. What we'll do next week with the increase of minimum wage and the extension of coverage, that'll benefit labor. The racially prejudiced craft union officials who control racially segregated unions, which refuse to accept or admit black workers, have long resented me. But it's too late. It's too late. You know, there was a great poet named Samuel Hoffenstein. I guess you young people will forget him and remember him when Hollywood stole him from Greenwich Village and my friendship and corrupted him with a touch of meat ass and paid him a couple of hundred thousand a year as a scriptwriter.
But back in the days when Samuel Harvesting was poor and we were friends and he lived on Charles Street, he wrote a fabulous, fabulous book of poetry. Better than even Ogden Nash. It was called Poems in Praise of Practically Nothing. And he had in there what I call the credo of the AFL-CIO leadership. Come weal, W-E-A-L, come woe, my status is quo. Contrary to newspaper reports, there is no conflict or ill feelings between me and my dearly beloved friend from across the border in Massachusetts, John McCormick. We are not eyeball to eyeball and nose to nose, or even chin to chin on Sidus Picketing. But I told him yesterday, you're still my boss. And he laughed and said, tell that to the press, please, Doc, and so I'm doing it tonight. He's my friend. But I still got common Sidus in my pocket. Yesterday, my colleague Wilbur Mills from Arkansas, I got colleagues, you know, from Arkansas and Mississippi, too, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, stated flatly he would not bring up the administration's bill to ease the East-West trade relations. You saw that. Defiance of the speaker, defiance of the administration, of course not. It's merely the operation of the congressional system of checks and balances, the rules of the House, and there are only 12 major committees, and I happen to be chairman of one of them. And I am an integral part of that system. A lot of you are going to go away and say Powell is egotistic and egoist and egocentric. All I'm trying to tell you is the white power structure is going with the wind. That's what I'm trying to tell you. More than just the togetherness of black and white men, this new power structure must bring a new system of values to our society by paying homage to the creative minds and leadership of our scholars. Politicians and the Dow Jones brainwashed businessmen are too narrow a base for a new power structure. Our professors and our teachers must also enjoy an honored place in the councils which shall decide man's survival and future on earth. And so we replace the shop-worn ethic of white supremacy, of the white power structure, with a new ethic for the new power structure. And the new power structure does not need an ethic because it has ethnic. Sooner this company accepts the beauty and efficiency of more ethnic in its total life, the sooner this nation shall be entitled to its claim of greatness in the catalogs of history. What is that famous Brown University? What is it? Latin? Esperemus? Well, my Latin and Greek is about 35 years old. What does it mean? Something about God we trust? Our hope is in God. All those Torquemadas who are in our midst will now ask questions. Spanish Inquisition will begin. I'll be very happy to do my best, and I am not the slightest bit thin-skinned. I'm too old. I'll be 60 years old in 2 years, so I've lost all my thick skin. Gentlemen up there. The chances of home rule in the District of Columbia are based upon getting rid of Macmillan of South Carolina, who's chairman of the district committee, and Byrd of West Virginia, who told me he was a former member of the Ku Klux Klan, and the way he's acting now, I think he's still a member. Otherwise, it's hopeless. On the front page of this morning's newspaper in Washington, there is a story where Macmillan of South Carolina has requested
that the Capitol Park Commission dig up all the azaleas and magnolias that they have planted in the Negro section, Pennsylvania Southeast, and put them in another section.
Can you imagine people that stupid? You know what? I said the other day that the lowness of the IQ of the American voter is only exceeded by the people they send to Congress. I told you I was crazy. Any more questions?
Yes, sir.
Was that the what amendment? I can't hear. That's a good idea.
What do you think of the Morse-Grunning amendment, or Grunning? You know, the thing of not sending people who have been drafted to Vietnam.
Maybe, well, maybe Morse is my beloved friend, and we were just talking to him yesterday. But Morse has as many amendments as I do, and I can't keep up with him, and he can't keep up with me. Now, which one are you referring to?
Maybe he hasn't really introduced this yet.
What's that?
Maybe he hasn't really introduced this yet.
You're ahead of Morse, then.
But there's a thing. They're pushing an amendment to get a bill through saying that people who are drafted cannot be sent to Vietnam without a special bill by Congress.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. He wants to legalize the slaughter. Oh, I see.
I think it's better
than the Morse amendment, and I better call him up tonight and tell him about this. He may not know he's got one. I think better than that one
I'm
is
sorry.
The one that some members of the faculties of the universities put forward last Friday night, that anyone who is drafted through the deferment tests shall be given the chance to serve in the Peace Corps, the War on Poverty, or Adam Powell's staff. I think that's the one I agree with. Seriously, I hope you read last week's Newsweek, which indicates on the basis of the call-up per month that the draft deferment tests are no longer of any value whatsoever. In Newsweek, hope you read it. All right. I'll call up Wayne Morse tonight and tell him. What's your name so I can tell him the use of this? Huh? All right, okay, all right. An anonymous stupid Brown, okay. All right. Yes, sir.
Poverty program is working in Harlem, working or not working?
Well, I would say that that when you consider this, the newest idea on a federal basis, and the fact that it has been working but a brief time, and the fact that we in my committee did not do a job tightening up the legislation as we have just done, because we wanted to give Sarge as much freedom as possible to get this idea moving, I would say that the program in Harlem is about the best in this nation. This does not mean that it's perfect at all, and I think that there will be considerable changes made there and all across the country. But the poverty program has had its growing pains as anything. This is the most radical idea on a federal basis that we have seen in a long time in the history of our republic. And it's a good idea. It's a good idea. We've got to do everything we can to nurture it. And let me give you a brief things that I've done in the past few weeks, and my committee has supported me. For instance, nobody can be a member of a community action program I'm not talking about the umbrella one. I'm talking about the local one in various target areas of poverty who does not live in that area. That's one of the new laws we've passed. Nobody will receive more than $12,500 from the federal government as a salary. If a city or a state or a county wants to pay more than $12,500, then that's up to them. The federal commitment is that. 20% of all of the monies in the community action section can be directly funded to an agency without having to go through City Hall. See, my philosophy in this, and this is why the politicians don't like it, my philosophy is that I believe that the American people have a right to recapture the spirit of 1776 and fight City Hall. We've been going along all these years with the slogan, you can't fight City Hall. I say, yes, we should fight it. And that's what the poverty program does. It puts in the hands of the lowest down the ability to fight City Hall. And you know, you can't lose in that. Because regardless of who they put in there, it's got to be better than what we got now. See, I'm crass. I'm a very crass, calloused politician. I've been in public life 36 years, and I don't want to disillusion you, but I just want to tell you the facts of life. Yes, sir. Anybody else? No girls here? Where's Pembroke? I used to date a girl from Pembroke. Way at the top? Yeah, as you are. Oh, you're not from Pembroke, though. You know where he's from, by the way? He's from Wellesley. No, truthfully, he's from Wesley, and I always kid him and say he's from Wellesley. He's from Wesley. Okay, go ahead.
Your personal knowledge of Malcolm X and what...
You want to get into it now? Now, if one of the girls asked me that, I wouldn't mind answering it.
And then an evaluation of his political or
who?
Leadership role, Malcolm
what?
X.
Who?
Malcolm X.
Malcolm X? Oh, Malcolm X and I disagreed all the way. But Malcolm X and I were very dear friends. And Malcolm X was very close with me, and I was close with him. I believe, and this is why I never fought such odd characters as Father Divine and Daddy Grace, I believe that anyone that's trying to help people, and this is where Malcolm X and I differed, because the black Muslims did preach a little bit of hatred. Although, now this is very interesting, this is why Malcolm X was assassinated. I was Saturday night at a dance of a political club at Audubon Ballroom, and the bloodstains are still on the floor, where he was killed. He went on a mission to Mecca, and he discovered for the first time in his life that the Muslims over there were blue-eyed and blonde-haired. And he lost all of his hatred for white people. And when he got back here, black Muslims said, well, he's no longer any value for us, and that's why he was assassinated. But Malcolm X was, he had something. He had something. I think he was a man that never, of course, never, I know, he never lived to really realize his potential of greatness. And he got changed a lot when he went to Mecca, and especially in Cairo and the Arab countries. It's too bad. We haven't got many people in America, black or white, who are willing to break from the cult of mediocrity. The cult of mediocrity, which was created by McCarthy and brought to its finest point by Eisenhower.
One of the young men asked me on the way from the airport here, someone might ask me, what about the draft deferment test in the 50s? No one's asked me that, so I'll answer it. is because the young people in the 50s were living under this crust of mediocrity. Today we have a ferment and a thrust all over this nation, black and white. And the campuses are coming to life. I'm the old man of the Black Revolution, as you know. As Martin Luther King said the other day at Abyssinia Church when he preached the sermon, he said, long before some of us could talk or some of us were born, I was preaching what's happening now. It's in a book, by the way, which you can't even get in your library. It's in the rare book collection of the Library of Congress called Marching Blacks. And I am thrilled to death to see what's happening on the campuses of this nation. Whether right or wrong, doesn't matter. There's a ferment. There's a thrust. There's a divine discontent. There's an itch that you can't scratch. I love that. And God, don't stop. Don't stop. Keep on. I'm a Christian, as you know, and Jesus once said, woe unto them who are at ease in Zion. Blessed are ye when all men shall revile you and persecute you. Any more questions? I'd love to answer. You're not asking me any questions that make me mad. Yes, sir. No. Oh, no. Oh, no. I organized the first demonstrations in Harlem in 1930, and I never lost a single fight picket line otherwise for 11 years. I believe in protests and demonstrations. I believe that's the American scene. And I believe that that's the new camp we ought to have. That's our pop art now. Demonstrations, yes indeed. Important, important. Even if you don't know what you're demonstrating for, demonstrate. It makes you feel good. Yes, sir, way up in the back, the last row.
Nate. Can you return to New York State legally?
Who wants to leave all these girls at Pembroke College? Hell no. Yeah, I go into New York State anytime I want to. The Congress adjourns, and then I go fishing during the wintertime in Puerto Rico. Then I go back to New York State in January. It's a wonderful life, wonderful life. Congress adjourns around September, October, and then I go away for the winter. And then I come back January, and then I can go to New York all I want to. And I wish I could take all of you with me. But you girls won't answer me. You're not from Pembroke. I want somebody from there. We are. Come on. You know, I'm going to ask and tell you something. I sent a mission to Moscow under Edith Green, the gentlelady from Oregon on my committee. Do you know how many doctors Soviet Russia has that are women, percentage-wise? 76%. You know how many we got in the United States? 6%. So one male doctor on the streets of Moscow comes up to Edith Green one day and said, you are Edith Green, and you're chairman of the Congress Empowerment Committee, yes, and he authored the FEPC, yes. Could you give me a copy of the FEPC, because we need it against males here in Moscow. I'm glad to see one woman tonight ask a question. Go right ahead.
May I ask a question about South Africa?
Oh, yes. Anything you answer, I'll tell you in dirty words afterwards. And in clean words now. Mm-hmm. 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 Economic sanctions, boycott. I was the first one, as a matter of record, when Jimmy Forrestal was the secretary. See you, baby. Peace is wonderful.
Can you tell
you suggest a more effective way of refusing to be drafted rather than other than burning your draft card?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, I tell you what. We're working on this in the committee, and I really wish, I knew this question was coming tonight, I wish I could say something more affirmative. We did get, as I said, the fingerprinting out of the way, but we're working very hard to see if we can't get an option for those who ought to be drafted for service in other areas of the federal government. Now, of course, as I said before, Newsweek brought out the statistics from the Defense Department that the draft deferment tests are now of no value. Of course, the way the war is escalating and Premier Key saying he's not going to have elections for a year, we've just appropriated $1.5 billion to build permanent installations in South Vietnam. I think that it's just a question of time that the draft deferment group will be called on. But it does give us a little breathing space so that we can try to work in the administration to see if we can get a set of rules that'll give a multiple choice to those men who are going to be at the bottom of the pile tomorrow. Yes, sir.
Is your son also a pacifist?
I don't know. You see, the reason why I don't know what he is because, first, he's 19, and second, he's 6 feet four and a half, and third, he weighs 240 pounds. And see, I'm 6'3", and I only weigh 190, so all I do is say, yes, sir. Yeah, sir. Anything you say. I don't know. Okay. There we are. Pembroke Riz, it's beautiful back here. No? No Pembroke? Huh?
I'd like to know how you view the activities of America's number one atheist.
Who said she's number one? I thought I was number one. I don't know what you mean by the question, frankly. Oh, that. Oh, yes, yes. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yes. On the prayer and all that and all that. Good. Excellent. Excellent. I believe in people who keep things disturbed. I believe in the people, even though I do not believe in their beliefs. Believe in the people who keep things disturbed. Yes, indeed. I know who you mean now. I think she's doing a fine job. I saw where there's a new suit that was filed as regards the, it was Virginia, Maryland yesterday ruled in favor of the same type of philosophy that she has been advocating. Mm-hmm. Who's the senior member of the press? Because when I have a press conference, he always says, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Somebody over here?
Recently, Robert Kennedy, I believe, warned the United States government about jumping to the aid of any country that would scream communist overthrow. Have you looked into the possibility of, say, stimulating a bill that would cut off federal aid to countries that, you know, had an unfair political system, especially in South America?
Well, I tell you, if we had a bill that became the law to cut off aid to countries that had an unfair political system, we wouldn't have aid to any countries. That would begin with De Gaulle and go right on up the line. I know what you're trying to say. You're talking about the Yugoslavia, our aid to Yugoslavia, and so forth. I think the matter of foreign policy is not a matter for the House, which is the place where appropriations must originate. I think the matter of foreign policy
is a matter for our Department of State and our president to decide in terms of aid. I do think that our president, Department of State, should use these massive funds as a cutting edge in areas which are anti-democratic, such as I said before, Rhodesia, Union South Africa. But I don't think that... using the United States dollar as your bludgeon is sort of an America Uberalis philosophy, which is just as bad or most as armed force. But I do believe that in areas where people are openly undemocratic, that there should be a more conscionable use of our funds than now. Yes, sir. Yes. All right. In the first place, we passed, as I said, 3-1 a week before last, the new amendments to the FEPC section of the Civil Rights Act. These new amendments have in them a sleeper. On the surface, they are amendments to give the commissioner cease and desist orders where a question of fact cannot be appealed. In other words, to stop the foot dragons going on now using the federal courts. But also in there's a section where the unions must give to the commissioner a quarterly report on their progress in the administration of apprenticeship training programs. Now, in conference day before yesterday with the president of one of our biggest unions in New York, Local 65, David Livingston and his officials, David Livingston went so far, and I want to develop this, Chuck, in a subsequent talk, to suggest to Morris Doswell of the Negro American Labor Council, who's emerging now as the number one man since Phil Randolph is so old and so sick, that Negroes and Puerto Ricans and Mexicans in areas where they are not being included shall set up their own unions. Not make these unions to the exclusion of whites, but make them unions which are controlled by Negro, Puerto Rican, Mexican-American, Asiatic descent, and in many areas of the United States in the craft unions, Jews are excluded. And to start setting up unions, because this apprenticeship training program that is carried on by the craft unions is absolutely hopeless. I don't know how it's going to be changed. See, they don't get any federal money, and there is no federal law. Now, the nearest thing to it is the FEPC, which we passed out week before last, which, by the way, Mike Mansfield and Senator Dirksen jointly have tabled in the Senate. Tell you that IQ is lower than I thought it was. Mike Mansfield and Dirksen have jointly tabled a move to cut out apprenticeship training discrimination. Now, also in this area, we can utilize, and I talked to Bill Wirtz about this several times, including yesterday afternoon when Gene Foley was in the office, about putting up our own apprenticeship training programs on the Manpower Development Training Act and the new Vocational Education Act that Carl Perkins brought out a couple of years ago, setting up our own. See, the problem is they just won't let these people get a chance to be trained.
Another slick one they have is you can't be trained unless you have a high school diploma. Now, you go into an area, New York, the Benjamin Franklin High School in my district, which has several courses in vocational education, and I just learned last week that only 3% of those who graduate from that high school get a high school diploma. 97% get a high school certificate. And that school is almost 100% Puerto Ricans and Negro. Good school, too. Excellent facilities. But this is a trick, and I just found out last week. I've got an investigator working on it now. Yes, sir. You don't go to Pembroke either, do you? Go ahead.
Congress Powell.
Must be a Baptist preacher.
Hardly, I'm a Methodist. Same thing. A congressman, during your discourse, you spoke about the one of several Powell amendments regarding the shedding off of funds from the school systems that do not desegregate. In your opinion, has it had its desired effect?
It has not had the effect that I personally would like to see come to pass, but it is the only method that has brought any success, and I have been in a constant dialogue with former Commissioner Keppel, Francis Keppel, and the former Commissioner and the present Commissioner of Education, Howe, on guidelines. And I can assure you that the person who gets the lowest mark in Brown University tomorrow morning in the draft deferment test cannot possibly write as unintelligible reply as the Commissioner of Education of the United States. Now, the only thing that let's show you how back with the Americans. Under the bills that I put out, we now have, instead of 21 super grades in the Commissioner of Education's office, we now have 42. Super grades are when you make $20,000, $22,000, $25,000 a year. These are the real brains. Okay. So they pick, as Commissioner of Education, a very charming guy named Francis Keppel from Harvard, to run this stable of PhDs, and he's got a BA. So they kicked him upstairs and escalated him out, and then they brought in Commissioner Howe, who still has a BA, and who's on trial before the New York State FEPC for bouncing a Negro teacher out of Scarsdale High School when he was principal without giving her a hearing. And out of the 42 super grades, despite conferences repeated with, who was there before Celebrez? Oh, yeah, Ribicoff. Ribicoff, Celebrez. Just the other day, John Gardner, Wilbur Cohen, all the brass of HEW, and Howe was there too. Out of 42 super grades, we not only can't get a Negro, and you sent him a list. Now, how many PhDs was it, Jerry? 57. Incidentally, his family has more PhDs that we know of any family in the United States. Seven PhDs. We have a list of 57. Seven of yours, I'm sure. don't let this nepotism worry you too much, yeah? And not only not a Negro in a program which is directly oriented from my committee, but we can't get him to appoint a woman.
Can't get them to appoint a woman. The head of the VISTA program, a woman, Dr. Vannetta Washington, Women's Job Corps, Women's Job Corps. All of a sudden, they reached down and found some little Scrooge who was what? An accountant? And he was appointed last week head of the Women's Job Corps. The only woman we had in the War and Poverty Program. You women aren't doing a good job. Somewhere you're falling down the line. I don't know what's happening. But that's the problem. That's the problem. It's a mess. It's a mess in Washington. And all I can say is everything you read in the paper is totally true. Lady, oh, God bless you.
Well, you see, we are dealing with a lot of men that are like that. When you hang around Washington long enough, then people either forget you, forgive you, or are scared of you. Hershey has been there. Hoover's another one. Who else was it I said today? Hoover and who else? Who was it? Come on, don't be ashamed. Huh? Oh, I won't mention that. No. No. You're right. Thank you. Yeah. But Hershey has just been around there so long that I guess you wouldn't call Hershey a sacred cow. Sacred bull. Sacred bull. And Hoover's the same. Same thing. It's fantastic. You wouldn't believe it. And it's so cute to see all your little pink-cheeked children coming to Washington to see the Capitol. And the guides show you the pictures, you know, and the statue of Daniel Webster and everything. And go on home. And nothing's happened. And nothing will happen. Yeah, I'm going to take 5 more minutes. I got on Jimmy Hoffa's watch, by the way. I think I stole it from him.
Dick Gregory was here last week, and he said that he was... he's running for mayor against Daley, and he said that they're out to beat... not only Daley, but Dawson, Representative Dawson, and Douglas.
Against any colleague of mine, unless he's from Mississippi.
Do you think that this machine has really been collaborating in a way to protect the segregated school system in Chicago? Do you think maybe it's time for a change for people like Congressman Dawson to be defeated, or do you?
I will not say anything against any of my colleagues in public. But I will say the superintendent's been kicked out. And Chuck, before I stole him from Chicago, the editor of the Chicago Daily Defender. And I don't know whether this new man is any good either.
I don't know. Now, I tell you one thing, and I want to tell you this to you, and I say this to young people wherever I go. Don't be afraid of getting your hands dirty. Get into the back room of the clubhouse, back in the smoke-filled room, work, learn the ropes. Because unless you belong to a club, I mean the dirty kind, one flight up with the big fat guy smoking cigars, unless you are a part of that operation, you will never have the freedom of choice at an election. When you go to the polls and you think you're an American citizen exercising your franchise, you have only a choice of a Democrat or Republican who have been pre-chosen. You have no opportunity to participate in the democratic process unless you get right in there where it's dirty and nasty, where the fat boys talk filthy language, and all that.
and talk right back to him and get on and then slug and fight with him. That's the only way. Otherwise, we're going to have this same miasma for the rest of your life that I've been witnessing all of mine. Yes, sir.
Would you have urged the Freedom Democratic Party delegates to the Democratic Convention in 1960 at Atlantic City to have accepted the compromise offer with the Mississippi delegation, with the regular Mississippi delegation?
I worked with them just like that. And whatever they told me to do, I did. I followed them right down the line. In fact, I believe they were wrong in accepting a compromise. But I said, that's your decision.
That's your decision. Huh? Oh, yeah, he just told me something. The only way they got on the floor was they used my pass. That's true. You can't get on the floor unless you have this badge, you know. Yes, sir.
With this as a backdrop, how do you feel about the actions of the Black Panther Party in the Alabama election of last week?
We had a conference yesterday in my office with Henry Arrington, who is Martin Luther King's lawyer down in Florida. That's the name of the guy from the United... Huh? Bill Wise, United Negro College Fund. And we just came right down to what we call, you and I call, the nitty-gritty, you know? you know what I mean? They don't understand. And and we said, we just ain't got any Negro organizations. Haven't got any. Even Martin Luther King's lawyer admitted, Martin Luther King organization, that's not ours. Half of the money or more comes from Mr. Charlie. And whoever pays, you know, is going to call the tune. So I always believe. See, that's why I'm so arrogant. This is a hockey rink, right? Huh? And that's why I don't give a damn. Because I am the minister of the second oldest Baptist church, black or white, in New York City. Nobody controls that church but black people. I have been in Congress for 22 years and nobody sends me but black people. And we haven't got a single Negro national leader, including my beloved friend Martin Luther King, who doesn't have to listen. And Mr. Charlie calls it to him. That goes for Roy Wilkins, Whitney Young, who called up on the phone 3 days ago and cried to Chuck. He can cry all he wants to. The nearest thing we got is SNCC. That's the nearest thing we got. SNCC down in Mississippi. John Lewis. And you know how bad off they are? Sent out a form letter a few months ago asking for contributions. Just a mimeograph form letter. So I just stolen $100 from somebody, and I sent $100 down to him, and I got a letter back from John Lewis and said, thank God, because when your $100 came, we had $4.17 left in our treasury to pay the salaries that week. Sitting there with Ralph Abernathy and Martin Luther King, and Chuck was there, Andy Young the other day, and Abernathy says, well, he just got $125,000 from the Field Foundation. I don't care how independent you may think you are, when that man is putting the green in your pocket, he's keeping his hand in there with it.
Just one more.
One more question before I get mad. I might tell the truth. One more question. Yes, sir.
You may have already answered this question, seeing that I don't understand nitty-gritty and all that, but
He's coming over, huh?
Coming over?
From what I understand, after this disferment test is administered, we're going to send the we're going to defer the culturally gifted whites, and we're going to send the culturally deprived Negroes
and Mexicans and Puerto Ricans and Appalachian whites,
right, and a few culturally deprived whites,
mm-hmm.
To Vietnam to lay at the bottom of the pile. And my question is, I'm not exactly sure if you feel that our policy in Vietnam is justified or not. Because if you do feel that...
Well, I can't say that because I've said I'm a pacifist. Now, even if I wasn't a pacifist, I would go ahead and say, this is God's world. These are God's people everywhere. They're entitled to make up their own minds. The diplomatic corps in Saigon last week and the United States press agreed with them, said... There isn't even a South Vietnam. There isn't one. 60% of the country is controlled by the Viet Cong. The government is a shambles between the Buddhists and the Catholics and can never be reconciled. What business have we to think that that Teddy Roosevelt is still living with the big stick? That's my view. The CIA puts a Batista out of Cuba and we get a Fidel Castro.
Incidentally, the CIA chief came to see me yesterday.
Look at Dominican Republic.
Trujillo,
go on. Now we're in charge.
Which is worse? The people themselves have got to make up their minds, just as you would not like imposed upon you, or I should say, we would not like imposed upon us, a form of government that we don't like. If we can do business with Soviet Russia and Yugoslavia, if we could do business with Trujillo and Batista, then why can't we do business with the largest nation in the world, regardless of whether we like or dislike their policies?
You know the story because you're students about the whole Chiang Kai-shek situation in China. You know. You know that Wellington Koo stole the money. $450 million that we sent Chiang Kai-shek to stop communism. And it's banked in New York City, Wellington Koo. And his family are outstanding members of the social circle of New York City with the money that we sent to Chiang Kai-shek. You know that Chiang Kai-shek and his son have imposed upon beautiful people on the island of Formosa a dictatorship that they do not want. And that Chiang Kai-shek's own son is one of the worst tyrants living in this world today. You know it. If you don't know it, then you ought to get some new political science teachers here. Good night. God bless you.